in the very heart of the ministry and stole from her the Horcrux she had unwittingly been wearing. With the fall of Lord Voldemort, Dolores Umbridge was put on trial for her enthusiastic cooperation with his regime and convicted of the torture, imprisonment, and deaths of several people. Some of the innocent Muggleborns she sentenced to Azkaban did not survive their ordeal.
Author's note. Once, long ago, I took instruction in a certain skill or subject. I am being vague, as vague can be, for reasons that are about to become obvious. And in doing so, came into contact with a teacher or instructor whom I disliked intensely on sight. The woman in question returned my antipathy with interest. Why we took against each other so instantly, heartily, and, on my side at least, irrationally, I honestly cannot say. What sticks in my mind is her pronounced taste for twee accessories. I particularly recall a tiny little plastic bow slide, pale lemon in colour, that she wore in her short curly hair. I used to stare at that little slide, which would have been appropriate to a girl of three, as though it was some kind of repellent physical growth. She was quite a stocky woman, and not in the first flush of youth, and her tendency to wear frills where I felt frills had no business to be, and to carry undersized handbags, again as though they had been borrowed from a child's dressing-up box, jarred. I felt, with a personality that I found the reverse of sweet, innocent and ingenuous. I am always a little wary when talking about these kinds of sources of inspiration, because it is infuriating to hear yourself misinterpreted in ways that can cause other people a great deal of hurt. This woman was not the real Dolores Umbridge. She did not look like a toad. She was never sadistic or vicious to me or anyone else, and I never heard her express a single view in common with Umbridge. Indeed, I never knew her well enough to know much about her views or preferences, which makes my dislike of her even less justifiable. However, it is true to say that I borrowed from her, then grossly exaggerated, a taste for the sickly sweet and girlish in dress. And it was that tiny little pale lemon plastic bow that I was remembering when I perched the fly-like ornament on Dolores Umbridge's head. I have noticed more than once in life that a taste for the ineffably twee can go hand in hand with a distinctly uncharitable outlook on the world. I once shared an office with a woman who had covered the wall space behind her desk with pictures of fluffy kitties. She was the most bigoted, spiteful champion of the death penalty with whom it has ever been my misfortune to share a kettle. A love of all things saccharine often seems present where there is a lack of real warmth or charity. So Dolores, who is one of the characters for whom I feel purest dislike, became an amalgam of traits taken from these and a variety of sources. Her desire to control, to punish, and to inflict pain, all in the name of law and order, are, I think, every bit as reprehensible as Lord Voldemort's unvarnished espousal of evil. Umbridge's names were carefully chosen. Dolores means sorrow, something she undoubtedly inflicts on all around her. Umbridge is a play on umbrage, from the British expression to take umbrage, meaning offence. Dolores is offended by any challenge to her limited worldview. I felt her surname conveyed the pettiness and rigidity of her character. It is harder to explain Jane. It simply felt rather smug and neat between her other two names.
Professor Kettleburn, given care of magical creatures is an optional subject rather than a compulsory one, Harry's Hogwarts cohort never encounters Professor Sylvanus Kettleburn. Based on the following description, however, it seems Kettleburn's lessons were at least as eventful as Hagrid's. And just what is it about care of magical creatures professors and underestimating dragons?
Sylvanus Kettleburn was the care of magical creatures teacher at Hogwarts until Harry's third year, when he was replaced by Rubeus Hagrid. Kettleburn was an enthusiastic and occasionally reckless man whose great love of the often dangerous creatures he studied and looked after led to serious injuries to himself and, occasionally, others. This fact led to no fewer than 62 periods of probation during his time of employment at the school, a record that still stands. Like Hagrid after him, he was prone to underestimating the risks involved in caring for creatures such as Occamies, Grindylows, and fire crabs, and once famously caused the Great Hall to catch fire after enchanting an Ashwinder to play the worm in a play of The Fountain of Fair Fortune. Kettleburn was a lovable, if eccentric, man, and his continuing employment at the school was evidence of the great affection in which staff and students held him. He finished his career with only one arm and half a leg. Albus Dumbledore presented him with a full set of enchanted wooden limbs on his retirement, a gift that had to be replaced regularly since, because Kettleburn's habit of visiting dragon sanctuaries in his spare time meant that his prosthetics were frequently set on fire.
Horace Slughorn. 5 years of studying potions under Snape's sneering tutelage means Harry is not exactly enamoured of the subject. Then along comes Professor Slughorn. And more significantly, the battered copy of Advanced Potion Making, previously owned by the Half-Blood Prince, that Slughorn unknowingly gifts Harry from the potions classroom cupboard. Now, when building a reputation for potions excellence, of course, it helps to have a book annotated by a previous expert at your disposal. But Harry has already won Slughorn's favour simply by virtue of being Harry Potter. As Dumbledore warns when they first visit Slughorn to persuade him back to Hogwarts, "He will undoubtedly try to collect you, Harry. You would be the jewel of his collection, the boy who lived, or as they call you these days, the chosen one." And as almost always, Dumbledore is right. Slughorn is quite the collector, and he has a definite talent for spotting talent. But is that his only skill? Raise a glass of oak-matured mead, and let's toast to the founder of the Slug Club.
Childhood. Horace Eugene Blackus Slughorn was born into an ancient wizarding family, the only son of doting and wealthy parents. Although a fundamentally good-tempered boy, he was educated to believe in the value of the old boys' network. His father was a high-ranking ministry official in the Department of International Magical Cooperation and encouraged to make friends of the right sort once he arrived at Hogwarts. The Slughorn family is one of the so-called Sacred 28, a select list of the only families designated pure-blooded by an anonymous author in the 1930s. And while Slughorn's parents were never militant in their pure blood beliefs, they encouraged a quiet belief in the family's innate superiority. Horace was sorted instantly into Slytherin upon arrival at Hogwarts. He proved himself an outstanding student. And while he did not follow his parents' implied instructions to the letter, numbering among his friends several talented Muggleborns, he practiced his own brand of elitism. Horace was drawn to those whose talents or backgrounds made them in any way distinctive, reveling in reflected glory and dazzled by celebrity of any description. Even as a boy, he was an embarrassingly loud name-dropper and would often refer to the Minister for Magic by his Christian name, happy to imply that the family were on closer terms with him than was really the case. Early teaching career. In spite of his considerable abilities, his admiration of those who enjoyed the limelight, and his parents' ambitions for him at the ministry, Horace Slughorn was never drawn to the cut and thrust of politics. He enjoyed his creature comforts and reveled in the vicarious delights of having high-achieving friends without much wanting to emulate any of them. Perhaps he knew in his heart of hearts that he was not the stuff of which great ministers are made, aware that he preferred a less taxing and more comfortable existence. When offered the job of potions master at Hogwarts, he was delighted to accept, having a great flair for teaching and a deep fondness for the old school. Subsequently promoted to head of Slytherin House, Slughorn remained a good-tempered and easygoing man. He had weaknesses, vanity, snobbery, and a certain lack of judgment when it came to the good-looking and talented, and yet he was devoid of cruelty or malice. The worst of which he could be accused during his teaching career is that he made far too great a distinction between those students whom he found amusing and promising and those in whom he saw no flicker of future greatness. The institution of the Slug Club, an out-of-hours dining and social club for his selected favorites, did nothing to assuage the feelings of those who were never invited. Slughorn undoubtedly had a good eye for latent talent. Over a 50-year period, numerous members of the Slug Club, handpicked by him, subsequently had dazzling careers in the wizarding world, in fields as diverse as Quidditch, politics, business, and journalism. Relationship with Voldemort. Unfortunately for Slughorn, one of his very favorite students, a handsome and exceptionally talented boy called Tom Marvolo Riddle, had ambitions that were far removed from the likes of the ministry or proprietorship of the Daily Prophet. Manipulative and charming when he chose, Riddle knew exactly how to flatter and cajole his doting potions master and head of house into parting with forbidden information. How to create Horcruxes. Most ill-advisedly, Slughorn gave his protégé the knowledge he had been lacking. Although it is not shown in the novels, we may deduce from what Professor Dumbledore tells Harry Potter about his own suspicions about Tom Riddle during the latter's school days, that Dumbledore would have warned his colleague Slughorn against allowing himself to be used by the boy. Slughorn, secure in his own judgment, which had been vindicated so many times, brushed off such warnings as paranoia on Dumbledore's part, believing the transfiguration teacher to have taken an unaccountable dislike to Tom from the moment he had fetched the boy from the orphanage in which he had been brought up. Slughorn remained enthralled to Riddle right up until the latter's departure from the school, when Slughorn was disappointed to discover that his prize pupil had not only turned down every wonderful job offer made to him, but vanished, showing no desire to keep in touch with the master with whom he had seemed to feel such an affinity. Slowly, over the ensuing months, Slughorn had to admit to himself that the affection Tom Riddle had seemed to feel for him might, after all, have been a pretense. Slughorn's guilty feelings about having shared a piece of dangerous magical knowledge with the boy intensified, but he suppressed them more determinedly than ever, confiding in no one. When a few years after Riddle's departure from the school, a dark wizard of immense power called Lord Voldemort became active in the wizarding world, Slughorn did not immediately recognize him as his old pupil. He had never been privy to the private name that Riddle was already using to his cronies at Hogwarts, and Voldemort had undergone several physical transformations since last they met. When Slughorn realized that this frightening wizard was indeed Tom Riddle, he was horrified. And on the night that Voldemort returned to Hogwarts, seeking a teaching post, Slughorn hid in his office, frightened that the visitor would come and claim acquaintance. Voldemort did not trouble to greet his former potions master on that occasion, but Slughorn's relief was short-lived. When the wizarding world fell into war, and rumors swirled that Voldemort had somehow made himself immortal, Slughorn was sure that it was he who had made Voldemort invincible by teaching him about Horcruxes. This guilt was misplaced, as Riddle already knew how to make a Horcrux and had feigned innocence in order to find out what might happen if a wizard made more than one. Slughorn became ill with guilt and fright. Albus Dumbledore, now headmaster, treated his colleague with particular kindness at this time, which had the paradoxical effect of increasing Slughorn's guilt, reinforcing his determination never to tell a living soul what a dreadful mistake he had made. Lord Voldemort made no attempt to seize Hogwarts on his first ascent to power. Slughorn believed, correctly, that he was safest remaining in his post, rather than risking the outside world while Voldemort was at large. When Voldemort met his match upon attacking the infant Harry Potter, Slughorn was even more jubilant than most of the wizarding population. If Voldemort had been killed, Slughorn reasoned, then he could not have made a Horcrux, which meant that he, Slughorn, was innocent after all. It was Slughorn's extremity of relief and the disjointed phrases he let fall in the first rush of emotion after hearing of Voldemort's defeat that first alerted Dumbledore to the possibility that Slughorn had shared dark secrets with Tom Riddle. Dumbledore's gentle attempts to question Slughorn, however, caused him to clam up. A few days later, Slughorn, who had now completed a half century of service to the school, tendered his resignation. Retirement. Horace intended to enjoy a delightful retirement, free from the cares of teaching and the burden of guilt and fear that had been with him for years. He returned to the comfortable home of his parents, now dead, where he had enjoyed school holidays, now taking up permanent residence. For nearly a decade, Slughorn enjoyed his well-stocked cellar and library, paying occasional visits to old members of the Slug Club and hosting reunion feasts at his home. He missed teaching, however, and occasionally felt a sad chill at the thought that the famous faces of tomorrow were now passing through Hogwarts without the slightest knowledge of who he was. About a decade into Slughorn's retirement, word reached him through his extensive contacts that Lord Voldemort was still alive, although in some disembodied form. This, of all the news in the world, was what Slughorn most feared, for it suggested that his deepest dread had been well-founded, that Voldemort lived on in some fragmented spectral form, because his younger self had successfully created one or more Horcruxes. Slughorn's retirement now became a fraught affair. Sleepless and frightened, he asked himself whether he had been wise to leave Hogwarts, where Voldemort had previously feared to invade, and where Dumbledore would surely be well informed about what was going on. Hiding. Shortly after the conclusion of the Triwizard Tournament at Hogwarts, which Slughorn had been following with rapt attention in the press, the wizarding world erupted with fresh rumors. Harry Potter had survived the competition under dubious circumstances, returning to the Hogwarts grounds, clutching the body of a fellow competitor whom he claimed had been killed by a reborn Voldemort. While Harry's story was widely dismissed by both the Ministry of Magic and the wizarding press, Horace Slughorn believed it. Confirmation came 3 nights after the death of Cedric Diggory, when the Death Eater, Corban Yaxley, arrived at Slughorn's house under cover of night, clearly intending to recruit him or take him by force to Voldemort. Slughorn reacted with a speed that would have astounded those who had watched him grow slower and fatter through the years of his retirement. Transfiguring himself into an armchair, he successfully evaded Yaxley's detection. Once the Death Eater had left, Slughorn packed a few necessities into a bag, locked up his house behind him, and went on the run. For over a year, Slughorn moved from house to house, often squatting in muggle dwellings when the owners were away, because he did not dare stay with friends who might subsequently betray, whether willingly or under duress, his whereabouts. It was a miserable existence, made still more wretched by the fact that he did not know precisely what Voldemort wanted from him. He thought it most likely that his old student simply wanted to recruit him to his army, which was still small compared to what it had been at the height of his previous power. In his darkest moments, however, Slughorn wondered whether Voldemort did want to kill him, to prevent him ever betraying the source of the latter's continuing invulnerability. Later teaching career. Though Slughorn's charms and hexes kept him a few steps ahead of the Death Eaters, they were insufficient to keep him concealed from Albus Dumbledore, who finally ran him to ground in the village of Budley Babbitton, where Slughorn had commandeered a muggle dwelling. The headmaster was not fooled by the disguise that had hoodwinked Yaxley, and asked Slughorn to return to Hogwarts as a teacher. As an added inducement, Dumbledore had brought along Harry Potter, whom Slughorn now met for the first time. The most famous student Hogwarts had ever seen, he was also the son of one of Slughorn's all-time favorite students, Lily Evans. Although initially resistant, Slughorn could not resist the combined allure of a safe place of residence and of Harry himself, who had a glamour that exceeded even Tom Riddle's. Slughorn suspected that Dumbledore might have a further motive, but was confident that he could resist Dumbledore's attempts to wheedle out of him any assistance he might have given Lord Voldemort. He armed himself against this eventuality by preparing a fake memory of the night that Riddle had approached him with a request to be taught about Horcruxes. Slughorn resumed his post as potions master at Hogwarts with gusto, once again instituting the Slug Club and attempting to collect all the most talented or well-connected students of the day. As Dumbledore had expected and intended, Slughorn was captivated by Harry Potter, whom he believed erroneously to be supremely talented in his own subject. Harry finally succeeded in prizing from Slughorn the true memory of his Horcrux conversation with Riddle after using Slughorn's own potion against him, Felix Felicis, which made Harry irresistibly lucky. Hogwarts under Death Eater rule. Once the school had been taken over by Lord Voldemort, with Severus Snape as headmaster and the Death Eater Carrows taking key roles in subjugating staff and pupils, Slughorn learned that Voldemort had nothing worse in store for him than to remain in post and teach pure and half-bloods. This he did, keeping his profile as low as he dared, though never enforcing the violent discipline advocated by the Carrows, and attempting to look after the students in his care as best he could. The Battle of Hogwarts. Slughorn's behavior during the most dangerous night of his life reveals the worth of the man. Initially, he appeared to have escaped the fight, having led the Slytherins out of the castle to safety. Once in Hogsmeade, however, he helped to rouse and mobilize the villagers, returning with Charlie Weasley at the head of reinforcements at a crucial point in the battle. What is more, he was one of the last three, with Minerva McGonagall and Kingsley Shacklebolt, to duel Voldemort before the latter's final confrontation with Harry. Slughorn sought redemption in these selfless acts of courage, risking his life against his erstwhile pupil. Slughorn's genuine remorse for the damage he had done in telling Riddle what he wanted to know is conclusive proof that he is not and never was Death Eater material. A little weak, a little lazy, and certainly snobbish, Slughorn is nevertheless kind-hearted, with a fully functional conscience. In his final test, Slughorn revealed himself to be implacably opposed to the dark arts. When his bravery at the Battle of Hogwarts was publicized, his actions, along with those of Regulus Black, which gained attention in the aftermath of Voldemort's demise, removed much of the stigma that had been attached to Slytherin House for hundreds of years past. Though now permanently retired, his portrait has a place of honor in the Slytherin Common Room.
Author's note. Quintus Horatius Flaccus was one of the greatest Roman poets, more commonly known as Horace. He gave Slughorn two of his Christian names. The name Slughorn derives from the Scots Gaelic for war cry, Sluagharm, which later gave rise to Slughorn, a battle trumpet. I love the word for its look and sound, but also for its many associations. The original Gaelic suggests a hidden ferocity, whereas the corrupted word seems to allude to the feeler of the Orion distinctus, or common land slug, which works well for such a seemingly sedentary, placid man. Horn also hints at his trumpeting of famous names and illustrious associations.
Potions. Slughorn and Snape are both expert potioneers, but the subject is not solely reserved for seemingly slippery Slytherins with deep reserves of courage. It is, however, a subject with hidden depths of its own. As Snape describes to Harry's first-year class,
I don't expect you will really understand the beauty of the softly simmering cauldron with its shimmering fumes, the delicate power of liquids that creep through human veins, bewitching the mind and snaring the senses. I can teach you how to bottle fame, brew glory, even stopper death.
Let's peek into the cauldron then and see what's floating beneath the surface.
It is often asked whether a muggle could create a magic potion, given a potions book and the right ingredients. The answer, unfortunately, is no. There is always some element of wand work necessary to make a potion. Merely adding dead flies and asphodel to a pot hanging over a fire will give you nothing but nasty-tasting, not to mention poisonous, soup. Some potions duplicate the effects of spells and charms, but a few, for instance the Polyjuice Potion and Felix Felicis, have effects impossible to achieve any other way. Generally speaking, witches and wizards favor whichever method they find easiest, or most satisfying, to produce their chosen end. Potions are not for the impatient, but their effects are usually difficult to undo by any but another skilled potioneer. This branch of magic carries a certain mystique, and therefore status. There is also the dark cachet of handling substances that are highly dangerous. The popular idea of a potions expert within the wizarding community is of a brooding, slow-burning personality. Snape, in fact, conforms perfectly to the stereotype.
Author's note. Chemistry was my least favorite subject at school, and I gave it up as soon as I could. Naturally, when I was trying to decide which subject Harry's arch-enemy Severus Snape should teach, it had to be the wizarding equivalent. This makes it all the stranger that I found Snape's introduction to his subject quite compelling.
I can teach you how to bottle fame, brew glory, even stopper death.
Apparently, part of me found potions quite as interesting as Snape did. And indeed, I always enjoyed creating potions in the books and researching ingredients for them. Many of the components of the various draughts and libations that Harry creates for Snape exist or were once believed to exist and have or were believed to have the properties I gave them. Dittany, for instance, really does have healing properties. It is an anti-inflammatory, although I would not advise splinching yourself to test it. Abizor really is a mass taken from the stomach of an animal, and it really was once believed that drinking water in which Abizor was placed could cure you of poisoning.
Polyjuice Potion. Proving that potion's expertise does not begin and end in Slytherin House, Hermione Granger, of course, brews up a perfect Polyjuice Potion early on in her second year at Hogwarts. Shame she doesn't get any marks for it, because it's really quite the feat.
The Polyjuice Potion, which is a complex and time-consuming concoction, is best left to highly skilled witches and wizards. It enables the consumer to assume the physical appearance of another person, as long as they have first procured part of that individual's body to add to the brew. This may be anything, toenail clippings, dandruff, or worse, but it is most usual to use hair. The idea that a witch or wizard might make evil use of parts of the body is an ancient one and exists in the folklore and superstitions of many cultures. The effect of the potion is only temporary, and depending on how well it has been brewed, may last anything from between 10 minutes and 12 hours. You can change age, sex, and race by taking the Polyjuice Potion, but not species.
Author's note. I remember creating the full list of ingredients for the Polyjuice Potion. Each one was carefully selected. Lacewing flies. The first part of the name suggested an intertwining or binding together of two identities. Leeches, to suck the essence out of one and into the other. Horn of a bicorn, the idea of duality. Knot grass, another hint of being tied to another person. Fluxweed, the mutability of the body as it changed into another. And boomslang skin, a shedded outer body and a new inner. The fact that Hermione is able to make a competent Polyjuice Potion at the age of 12 is testimony to her outstanding magical ability, because it is a potion that many adult witches and wizards fear to attempt.
Cauldrons. Essential for potions practice, first-year Hogwarts students are required to bring one cauldron, pewter, standard size 2, along with their wands, a telescope, a set of brass scales, and a set of glass or crystal phials, which is quite a lot of unusually shaped equipment to pack in a school trunk. Good thing cauldrons are magic.
Cauldrons were once used by muggles and wizards alike, being large metal cooking pots that could be suspended over fires. In time, magical and non-magical people alike moved on to stoves. Saucepans became more convenient, and cauldrons became the sole province of witches and wizards, who continued to brew potions in them. A naked flame is essential for the making of potions, which makes cauldrons the most practical pot of all. All cauldrons are enchanted to make them lighter to carry, as they are most commonly made of pewter or iron. Modern inventions include the self-stirring and collapsible varieties of cauldron, and pots of precious metal are also available for the specialist or the show-off.
Author's note. Cauldrons have had a magical association for centuries. They appear in hundreds of years' worth of pictures of witches and are also supposed to be where leprechauns keep treasure. Many folk and fairy tales make mention of cauldrons with special powers. But in the Harry Potter books, they are a fairly mundane tool. I did consider making Helga Hufflepuff's Horcrux a cauldron, but there was something slightly comical and incongruous about having such a large and heavy Horcrux. I wanted the objects Harry had to find to be smaller and more portable. However, a cauldron appears both in the four mythical jewels of Ireland. Its magical power was that nobody ever went away from it unsatisfied. And in the legend of the 13 treasures of Britain, the cauldron of Durnoch the Giant would cook meat for brave men, but not for cowards.
Chapter 15. Magical Artifacts. Cauldrons may be fairly commonplace in the classrooms of Hogwarts, but there are certain magical artifacts guaranteed to cause a stir even at a school of witchcraft and wizardry. From mythical, innately magical objects like the Sword of Gryffindor, to seemingly everyday items imbued with enchantment like the Mirror of Erised, Hogwarts is a place to keep things safe. It's not surprising, really. Hogwarts is built to keep its mostly teenage inhabitants secure, so what's a sword or a mirror? Magically hidden from Muggle eyes, bewitched to prevent apparition and disapparition in and out of the grounds, and manned by statues that can be activated to defend the boundaries with a single spell, Hogwarts is the perfect custodian. The Philosopher's Stone. Hagrid describes Hogwarts as one of the best places in the wizarding world for anything you want to keep safe. He was referring to a specific object, the Philosopher's Stone. Moved from Gringotts, which Hagrid calls the safest place in the world, the stone is installed in a forbidden corridor on the right-hand side of Hogwarts' third floor, where it is guarded by a three-headed dog and some tricky enchantments. There, it is safer than safe from outsiders, but alas, not from a certain two-faced Hogwarts professor called Quirinus Quirrell, who wanted to use the stone's elixir of life for his master, Voldemort.
Author's note. I did not invent the concept of the Philosopher's Stone, which is a legendary substance that was once believed to be real and the true goal of alchemy. The properties of my Philosopher's Stone conform to most of the attributes the ancients ascribed to it. The stone was believed to turn base metals into gold and also to produce the elixir of life, which could make you immortal. Genuine alchemists, the forerunners of chemistry and physicists, such as Sir Isaac Newton and the real Nicholas Flamel, sought, sometimes over lifetimes, to discover the secret of its creation. The stone is variously described as red and white in the many old texts in which it appears. These colours are important in most accounts of alchemy and are often interpreted as having symbolic meaning.
The Mirror of Erised. Harry manages to thwart Quirrell's attempt to get his unworthy hands on the Philosopher's Stone by means of another magical artifact, the Mirror of Erised. How's that possible? Let's reflect for a moment.
The Mirror of Erised is a very old device. Nobody knows who created it or how it came to be at Hogwarts School. A succession of teachers have brought back interesting artifacts from their travels, so it might have arrived at the castle in this casual manner, either because the teacher knew how it worked and was intrigued by it, or because they did not understand it and wished to ask their colleagues' opinions. The Mirror of Erised
is one of those magical artifacts that seems to have been created in a spirit of fun, whether innocent or malevolent is a matter of opinion, because while it is much more revealing than a normal mirror, it is interesting rather than useful. Only after Professor Dumbledore makes key modifications to the mirror, which has been languishing in the Room of Requirement for a century or so before he brings it out and puts it to work, does it become a superb hiding place and the final test for the impure of heart. The mirror's inscription, Eris ed straeru oit ube kafru oit on vosai, must be read backwards to show its true purpose.
Author's note. Albus Dumbledore's words of caution to Harry when discussing the Mirror of Erised expressed my own views. The advice to hold on to your dreams is all well and good, but there comes a point when holding on to your dreams becomes unhelpful and even unhealthy. Dumbledore knows that life can pass you by while you are clinging onto a wish that can never be or ought never to be fulfilled. Harry's deepest yearning is for something impossible, the return of his parents. Desperately sad though it is that he has been deprived of his family, Dumbledore knows that to sit gazing on a vision of what he can never have will only damage Harry. The mirror is bewitching and tantalizing, but it does not necessarily bring happiness.
The Sword of Gryffindor. The Mirror of Erised is not the only uniquely magical object to come to Harry's aid during a battle of wills with Voldemort. The Sword of Gryffindor does the very same, more than once. First, when Harry pulls it out of the sorting hat to defeat the Basilisk in the Chamber of Secrets, and later in Deathly Hallows, when Harry instructs Ron to destroy Slytherin's malicious locket with it. But the Sword of Gryffindor is a goblin-made object, which means its long and complicated history goes way beyond its unique Horcrux-destroying powers.
The Sword of Gryffindor was made 1,000 years ago by goblins, the magical world's most skilled metalworkers, and is therefore enchanted. Fashioned from pure silver, it is inset with rubies, the stone that represents Gryffindor in the hourglasses that count the house points at Hogwarts. Godric Gryffindor's name is engraved just beneath the hilt. The sword was made to Godric Gryffindor's specifications by Ragnuk I, finest of the goblin silversmiths and therefore king. In goblin culture, the ruler does not work less than the others, but more skillfully. When it was finished, Ragnuk coveted it so much that he pretended that Gryffindor had stolen it from him and sent minions to steal it back. Gryffindor defended himself with his wand, but did not kill his attackers. Instead, he sent them back to their king bewitched, to deliver the threat that if he ever tried to steal from Gryffindor again, Gryffindor would unsheath the sword against them all. The goblin king took the threat seriously and left Gryffindor in possession of his rightful property, but remained resentful until he died. This was the foundation for the false legend of Gryffindor's theft that persists in some sections of the goblin community to this day. The question of why a wizard would need a sword, though often asked, is easily answered. In the days before the International Statute of Secrecy, when wizards mingled freely with muggles, they would use swords to defend themselves just as often as wands. Indeed, it was considered unsporting to use a wand against a muggle sword, which is not to say it was never done. Many gifted wizards were also accomplished duelists in the conventional sense, Gryffindor among them. There have been many enchanted swords in folklore. The Sword of Nuadu, part of the four legendary treasures of Tuor de Dunon, was invincible when drawn. Gryffindor's sword owes something to the legend of Excalibur, the sword of King Arthur, which in some legends must be drawn from a stone by the rightful king. The idea of fitness to carry the sword is echoed in the Sword of Gryffindor's return to worthy members of its true owner's house.
Author's note. There is a further allusion to Excalibur emerging from the lake when Harry must dive into a frozen forest pool to retrieve the sword in Deathly Hallows, though the location of the sword was really due to a spiteful impulse of Snape's to place it there. For in other versions of the legend, Excalibur was given to Arthur by the Lady of the Lake and was returned to the lake when he died. Within the magical world, physical possession is not necessarily a guarantee of ownership. This concept applies to the three Deathly Hallows and also to Gryffindor's sword. I am interested in what happens when cultural beliefs collide. In the Harry Potter books, the most militant of the goblin race consider all goblin-made objects to be theirs by right, although a specific object might be made over to a wizard for his lifespan upon a payment of gold. Witches and wizards, like muggles, believe that once payment has been made, the object belongs to them and their descendants or legatees in perpetuity. This is a clash of values without a solution, because each side has a different concept of what is right. It therefore presents Harry with a difficult moral dilemma when Griphook demands the sword as payment for his services in Deathly Hallows.
Time Turner. Harry Potter is by no means the only Hogwarts student to handle unique magical artifacts. Indeed, when Hermione reveals in Prisoner of Azkaban that she's been using a time turner to do extra lessons, Harry is as surprised as anyone. Not least that a student, when presented with the chance to travel back in time, uses it as an opportunity to collect more homework. That's quite a commitment, even for Hermione. No wonder her regular use of a time turner doesn't last more than a term. Time turners clearly continue to hold a fascination for Hermione decades later. As the article below, which was written before Cursed Child was staged, explains, the Ministry of Magic's stock of time turners was destroyed during the Battle of the Department of Mysteries. But it was possible for certain non-scrupulous witches and wizards with the time, money, and appropriate expertise to build their own time turners. Completely unauthorized, of course. In Cursed Child, Hermione, now Minister for Magic, discovers one such illegal time turner. But does she take heed of the lessons she learns as a third year and destroy it before it falls into less studious hands? Well, let's just say even Hermione is not infallible.
In spite of the many Muggle fantasies around the subject, time travel is possible in only a limited sense, even in the magical world. While the subject is shrouded in great secrecy, investigations are ongoing in the Department of Mysteries, it appears that magic can take you only so far. According to Professor Saul Croker, who has spent his entire career in the Department of Mysteries studying time magic,
as our investigations currently stand, the longest period that may be relived without the possibility of serious harm to the traveller or to time itself is around 5 hours. We have been able to encase single-hour reversal charms, which are unstable and benefit from containment in small, enchanted hourglasses that may be worn around a witch or wizard's neck and revolved according to the number of hours the user wishes to relive. All attempts to travel back further than a few hours have resulted in catastrophic harm to the witch or wizard involved. It was not realized for many years why time travelers over great distances never survived their journeys. All such experiments have been abandoned since 1899, when Eloise Mintumble became trapped for a period of 5 days in the year 1402. Now we understand that her body had aged 5 centuries in its return to the present, and irreparably damaged, she died in St. Mungo's Hospital for magical maladies and injuries shortly after we managed to retrieve her. What is more, her 5 days in the distant past caused great disturbance to the life paths of all those she met, changing the course of their lives so dramatically that no fewer than 25 of their descendants vanished in the present, having been unborn. Finally, there were alarming signs during the days following Madam Mintumble's recovery that time itself had been disturbed by such a serious breach of its laws. Tuesday, following her reappearance, lasted 2.5 full days, whereas Thursday,
shot by in the space of 4 hours. The Ministry of Magic had a great deal of trouble in covering this up, and since that time, the most stringent laws and penalties have been placed around those studying time travel.
Even the use of the very limited amount of time-turners at the Ministry's disposal is hedged around with hundreds of laws. While not as potentially dangerous as skipping 5 centuries, the reuse of a single hour can still have dramatic consequences, and the Ministry of Magic seeks the strictest guarantees if it permits the use of these rare and powerful objects. It would surprise most of the magical community to know that time-turners are generally only used to solve the most trivial problems of time management, and never for greater or more important purposes. Because, as Saul Croker tells us, just as the human mind cannot comprehend time, so it cannot comprehend the damage that will ensue if we presume to tamper with its laws. The Ministry's entire stock of time-turners was destroyed during a fight in the Department of Mysteries about 3 years after Hermione Granger was granted permission to use one at Hogwarts.
Author's note. I went far too lightheartedly into the subject of time travel in Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. While I do not regret it, Prisoner of Azkaban is one of my favourite books in the series, it opened up a vast number of problems for me, because after all, if wizards could go back and undo problems, where were my future plots? I solved the problem to my own satisfaction in stages. Firstly, I had Dumbledore and Hermione emphasize how dangerous it would be to be seen in the past, to remind the reader that there might be unforeseen and dangerous consequences, as well as solutions in time travel. Secondly, I had Hermione give back the only time-turner ever to enter Hogwarts. Thirdly, I smashed all remaining time-turners during the battle in the Department of Mysteries, removing the possibility of reliving even short periods in the future. This is just one example of the ways in which, when writing fantasy novels, one must be careful what one invents. For every benefit, there is usually a drawback.
Pensive. Given pensives allow their owners to collect, observe, and relive thoughts and memories, these are magical artifacts that must be handled with care. Forget turning back time, wielding a sword, even pursuing immortality. Is there anything quite so frightening as being able to vividly revisit any previous experience, any time? Let's dive into the pensive and find out what it's all about.
A pensive is a wide and shallow dish made of metal or stone, often elaborately decorated or inlaid with precious stones, and carrying powerful and complex enchantments. Pensives are rare, because only the most advanced wizards ever use them, and because the majority of wizardkind is afraid of doing so. The perceived dangers of the pensive relate to its power over memory or thought. The pensive is enchanted to recreate memories so that they become relivable, taking every detail stored in the subconscious and recreating it faithfully so that either the owner or, and herein lies the danger, a second party is able to enter the memories and move around within them. Inevitably, those with things to hide, those ashamed of their pasts, those eager to keep hold of their secrets or protective of their privacy, will be wary of an object like the pensive. Even more difficult than the recreation of memories is the use of a pensive to examine and sort thoughts and ideas, and very few wizards have the ability to do so. Albus Dumbledore is seen using the Hogwarts pensive in this way, notably in Chapter 30 of Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire, when he adds thoughts to the pensive and Harry's face turns into Snape's. Dumbledore is reminding himself of the hidden connection between Snape and Harry, that Snape was in love with Harry's mother and is now, though immensely grudgingly, honor-bound to protect him. Traditionally, a witch or wizard's pensive, like their wand, is buried with them, as it is considered an intensely personal artifact. Any thoughts or memories left inside the pensive are likewise interred with their owner, unless he or she has requested otherwise. The Hogwarts pensieve, however, belongs not to any individual, but to the school. It has been used by a long line of headmasters and headmistresses who have also left behind their life experiences in the form of memories. This forms an invaluable library of reference for the headmaster or headmistress of the day. The Hogwarts pensieve is made of ornately carved stone and is engraved with modified Saxon runes, which mark it as an artifact of immense antiquity that predates the creation of the school. One unsubstantiated legend says that the founders discovered the pensieve half buried in the ground on the very spot where they decided to erect their school. The name pensieve is a homonym of pensive, meaning deeply, seriously thoughtful, but it is also a pun, the sieve part of the word alluding to the object's function of sorting meanings from a mass of thoughts or memories.
Chapter 16, Hogwarts Alumni. The Hogwarts pensieve may be a unique magical artifact that allows the current head to study the collective thoughts of their predecessors, but it is by no means the only source of reference available. The hallowed halls of Hogwarts are home not only to numerous robe-clad students, but to a whole host of other figures, many only too keen to offer staff the benefit of their experience. Ghosts, portraits, poltergeists, ex-students who might pop their head into your office fire at any moment. When running a school of magic, the list of alumni is dauntingly long and potentially overwhelming. But even if a Hogwarts head can never truly be alone with their thoughts, at least there's always someone around to listen. Ghosts. As Gryffindor's resident ghost, nearly headless Nick, explains to Harry, ghosts are neither here nor there. So if that's true, what are they? And where do they come from?
In the world of Harry Potter, a ghost is the transparent, three-dimensional imprint of a deceased witch or wizard, which continues to exist in the mortal world. Muggles cannot come back as ghosts, and the wisest witches and wizards choose not to. It is those with unfinished business, whether in the form of fear, guilt, regrets, or overt attachment to the material world, who refuse to move on to the next dimension. Having chosen a feeble simulacrum of mortal life, ghosts are limited in what they can experience. No physical pleasure remains to them, and their knowledge and outlook remains at the level it had attained during life, so that old resentments, for instance, at having an incompletely severed neck, continue to rankle after several centuries. For this reason, ghosts tend to be poor company, on the whole. They are especially disappointing on the one subject that fascinates most people. Ghosts cannot return a very sensible answer on what it is like to die, because they have chosen an impoverished version of life instead. Ghosts can pass through solid objects without causing damage to themselves or the material, but create disturbances in water, fire, and air. The temperature drops in the immediate vicinity of a ghost, an effect intensified if many congregate in the same place. Their appearance can also turn flames blue. Should part or all of a ghost pass through a living creature, the latter will experience a freezing sensation as though they have been plunged into ice-cold water. Witches and wizards are much more susceptible to what Muggles call paranormal activity, and will see and hear ghosts plainly, where a Muggle might only feel that a haunted place is cold or creepy. Muggles who insist that they see ghosts in perfect focus are either A, lying, or B, wizards showing off, and in flagrant breach of the International Statute of Secrecy.
Hogwarts ghosts. Nearly headless Nick is not the only ghost floating around Hogwarts. There are around 20 in all, including Ravenclaw's Grey Lady, Hufflepuff's Fat Friar, and Slytherin's Bloody Baron, not to mention the many ghostly extras known to pop up in bathrooms and classrooms and at Death Day parties. Sure, a drafty old castle is as good a place as any for a gang of ghosts to hang out, but how did they get there? Why do they stay? And what's really the deal with Professor Binns?
Hogwarts is the most heavily haunted dwelling place in Britain. And this is against stiff competition, as there are more reported ghost sightings / sensings on these damp islands than anywhere else in the world. The castle is a congenial place for ghosts because the living inhabitants treat their dead friends with tolerance and even affection, no matter how many times they have heard the same old reminiscences. Each of the four Hogwarts houses has its own ghost. Slytherin boasts the Bloody Baron, who is covered in silver bloodstains. The least talkative of the house ghosts is the Grey Lady, who is long-haired and beautiful. Hufflepuff House is haunted by the Fat Friar, who was executed because senior churchmen grew suspicious of his ability to cure the pox merely by poking peasants with a stick, and his ill-advised habit of pulling rabbits out of the communion cup. Though a genial character in general, the Fat Friar still resents the fact that he was never made a cardinal. Gryffindor House is home to Nearly Headless Nick, who in life was Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington. Something of a snob and a less accomplished wizard than he believed, Sir Nicholas lounged around the court of Henry VII in life, until his foolish attempt to beautify a lady-in-waiting by magic caused the unfortunate woman to sprout tusks. Sir Nicholas was stripped of his wand and inexpertly executed, leaving his head hanging off by a single flap of skin and sinew. He retains a feeling of inadequacy with regard to truly headless ghosts. Another notable Hogwarts ghost is Moaning Myrtle, who haunts an unpopular girl's toilet. Myrtle was a student at Hogwarts when she died, and she chose to return to school in perpetuity, with the short-term aim of haunting her arch-rival and bully, Olive Hornby. As the decades have rolled by, Myrtle has made a name for herself as the most miserable ghost in school, usually to be found lurking inside one of the toilets and filling the tiled space with her moans and howls.
Author's note. The inspiration for Moaning Myrtle was the frequent presence of a crying girl in communal bathrooms, especially at the parties and discos of my youth. This does not seem to happen in male bathrooms, so I enjoyed placing Harry and Ron in such uncomfortable and unfamiliar territory in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets and Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. The most productive ghost at Hogwarts is, of course, Professor Binns, the old history of magic teacher who fell asleep in front of the staff room fire one day and simply got up to give his next class, leaving his body behind. There is some debate as to whether or not Professor Binns realizes he is dead. While his entrance to lessons through the blackboard is vaguely amusing the first time students see it, he is not the most stimulating teacher. The inspiration for Professor Binns was an old professor at my university, who gave every lecture with his eyes closed, rocking backwards and forwards, slightly on his toes. While he was a brilliant man, who disgorged an immense amount of valuable information at every lecture, his disconnect with his students was total. Professor Binns is only dimly aware of his living students and is astonished when they begin asking him questions. In the very earliest list of ghosts I ever wrote for Hogwarts, I included Myrtle, initially named Wailing Wanda. Professor Binns, the Grey Lady, then called the Whispering Lady, and the Bloody Baron. There was also a Black Knight, the Toad, which left ectoplasm all over its classroom, and a ghost I rather regret not using. His name was Edmund Grubb, and the notes beside his name say, expired in the doorway of the dining hall, sometimes stops people getting in out of spite. Fat Victorian ghost, ate poisonous berries.
The Ballad of Nearly Headless Nick. Nearly Headless Nick's semi-detached head pops up in any conversation about the Wizarding World's ghosts, so perhaps the time has come to introduce him in a manner more befitting of his status. So, late lamented lords, ladies and gentlemen, please find herewith presented the tale of the most dearly departed Sir Nicholas de Mimsey Porpington, delivered in his own words, courtesy of J.K. Rowling.